His assailant was Arthur Bremmer. In the spring of 1977, Brian was found dead in a Las Vegas motel room from natural causes, unquote, the coroner said. Curiously, the word was issued before the official autopsy. Shortly thereafter, we were put in contact with two Beverly Hills call girls who claimed to have known Brian intimately. They had been servicing him on an average of twice a week for 4 years, they said, and usually were present at the same time. During the last year of his life, he was deeply depressed because his paramour had run off with another man. He became strung out on drugs, and his groin and thighs were pocked with bruises from hypodermic needles. No mention of these marks appeared on the coroner's report. The girl said that to relieve Brian's depression, they repeatedly titillated his enormous ego by getting him to, quote, talk about all the famous people you've hypnotized, unquote. As if by rote, Brian would begin with his role of deprogramming Albert DeSalvo in the Boston Strangler case for F. Lee Bailey, then boast that he had hypnotized Saran Saran. The girls didn't sense anything unusual in the Saran angle, for Brian had told them many times that he, quote, worked with the LAPD on murder cases, and they didn't know that he had absolutely no contact with Saran following the assassination. One of the girls thought that Brian had mentioned James Earl Ray once, but wasn't sure. Remember James Earl Ray. We'll come back to that in a second. But both girls were certain of the name Saran Saran. The call girls also linked Brian to the CIA. At the outset of their relationship with him, he instructed them to call an unlisted phone number at his office. If someone else answered, they were to say they were with the company, unquote, an insider's term for the CIA, and they would be put through to him. According to the girls, Brian repeatedly confided that he was not only a CIA agent, but involved in, quote, top secret projects, unquote. However, when he began bragging about such escapades as crawling over rooftops at night in Europe, they were a bit skeptical. We couldn't see Doc doing that kind of thing. Not all 300 pounds of him, we couldn't, one of the girls said, laughing. Upon Brian's death, his offices were sealed off to newsmen by his estate's probate lawyer, John Miner, who had also helped prosecute Saran as a deputy DA. There remains the question of Brian's claimed hypnotist-subject relationship with Saran and what role his connection with the CIA might have played in it. But there are a lot of things to pause and ruminate over in this whole passage about William Joseph Brian. First of all, note all the different people connected with this country's assassinations or attempted assassinations who he basically crosses paths with. We see that he, according to his secretary, received a call from Laurel, Maryland in connection with the Wallace shooting. Interesting in light of the fact that a person we talked about in the Guns of November, a guy named the Reverend Jerry Owen, who appears to have been involved with some kind of escape plan with Saran. Certainly he was an associate of Saran's and appears to have been in a position to drive a pickup truck and take someone, whether a Saran or a double or somebody, away from the Ambassador Hotel on the evening of the shooting. Now, one of his top religious followers, now recall, he also was a Bible-thumping fundamentalist, just like William Joseph Brian. Basically, one of Jerry Owen's top religious followers was Arthur Bremmer's sister. Now, recall also that William Joseph Brian is also a member of the same old Roman Catholic Church as David Ferry from the Kennedy assassination. Also very, very interesting. Worth noting, too, that John Miner, who sealed off William Joseph Brian's estate, turns out to be a deputy DA who prosecutes Saran. And keep in mind that the instructions given the call girls, that the fact that they were to call an unlisted number and say they were with the company if they wanted to get through to William Joseph Brian Jr. And there's an awful lot to keep in mind here. And remember that Brian himself said that he apparently worked with the National Security Establishment. He talked about the fact that during the Korean War, he supposedly helped combat brainwashing. And it's also interesting that the DDD DeSalvo automatic writing by William Joseph Brian may refer to Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler, who was, to a certain extent, found out as a result of Brian's work with hypnosis.
All right, and you are listening to Radio Free America. This is the June 5th, 1985, Radio Free America. You were listening to a taped segment of the November 29th, 1984 Radio Free America. And if you think you're confused, just imagine how we feel sitting around listening to ourselves when we're not actually talking. It gets pretty weird after a while. Anyway, but what you did hear was an extended segment from one of our mind control broadcasts on Radio Free America. It was a three-part series. And, of course, specifically the information about the possibility of Sirhan Sirhan being in some way mind-controlled, which, of course, is a bit of a boggling term since it calls up connotations of Lost in Space and Star Trek and things like this. But as Dave Emery mentioned before we went into that tape segment, capacity for this kind of work has been in the U.S. government for quite some time. We, in the three parts Radio Free America special, we concentrated on all the various programs that were instituted at the behest of the CIA and the Defense Department, were paid for with government money, in which people were brainwashed in a variety of ways. And we talked about evidence that people actually have been brainwashed into becoming couriers and assassins and things like that. So, as mentioned, the possibility of Sirhan Sirhan being himself some kind of a hypno-programmed patsy is perhaps not quite so strange as it might seem to the uninitiated or the uninformed.
All righty. Remember, too, all of the interesting connecting links that William Joseph Bryan had. His work for the CIA on the mind control programs, according to his own statements, his instructions to his call girls to say they were with the company when they contacted him. Also, interesting the fact that the lawyer who sealed his estate had helped prosecute Sirhan as an assistant district attorney. Worth noting also that William Joseph Bryan Jr. received an emergency call from Laurel, Maryland right after George Wallace was shot, and apparently it was in connection with the shooting of George Wallace. We're going to talk about another possible link between, well, a definite link between the Robert Kennedy assassination and the shooting of George Wallace later in the program, but remember, William Joseph Bryan, also a fellow named Manly Palmer Hall, a hypnotist who had contact with Sirhan, and also Sam Yorty, who we're going to talk about. Anyway, the indications that Sirhan was a mind-controlled patsy are there, and that's the information available. Now, one of the reasons why the massive discrepancies in the official version of the assassination of Robert Kennedy have never received the distribution that they should have, and in fact why they were never really entered into the official version of the assassination, concerns primarily the people who were in charge with investigating Robert Kennedy's assassination. Now, the investigative jurisdiction in this case belonged to the Los Angeles Police Department. What they did was to set up a special unit, which they called Special Unit Senator, or SUS. Now, this organization was, as I said, the LAPD body in charge with investigating the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Now, the two guys who headed this up were a fellow named Lieutenant Manuel Pena, last name P-E-N-A, and Sergeant Enrique Hernandez, H-E-R-N-A-N-D-E-Z. Both of these men are worth noting here because they both had contacts with the CIA. Returning again to the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by Christian and Turner.
Okay, one last thing to mention about the Pena and the Hernandez thing in general is that we're going to hear a little bit more about some of their connections in a moment, but mentioned here is going to be a name that I believe is the first time that you're hearing this name tonight, and that is Jerry Owen. He might have been mentioned once earlier in the broadcast. We will be illuminating the subject of Jerry Owen further on the broadcast because he's a key player, and he is, in many ways, was the prime factor that got Christian and Turner onto the trail of this evidence in the first place because of a story that he told to the police. So we will be talking more about Jerry Owen later. All you really need to know about him at this point is that he is a key player, apparently, in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Okay, reading again from the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, 1978 Random House hardcover by William Turner and John Christian. The choice of Lieutenant Manuel Pena, or Manuel Pena, for the key slot in SUS, Special Unit Senator, was a curious one. Among members of the force and the Mexican-American community, Pena was a living legend. Reputedly, he had killed 11 suspects, quote, in the line of duty more than any other officer in the history of the department. In Special Unit Senator, Houghton described him as a, quote, stocky, intense, proud man of Mexican-American descent, unquote, with 22 years of experience under his belt at the time. Houghton boasted that Pena had commanded detective divisions, supervised a bank robbery squad, and, quote, spoke French and Spanish and had connections with various intelligence agencies in several countries, unquote. What we did not know at the time, the authors write, that Pena and Hernandez interrogated Jerry Owen was that both had long-standing connections with the CIA. Our first clue about Pena came months later when a faded newspaper article came to our attention. On November 13, 1967, more than 6 months before the Robert F. Kennedy slaying, The San Fernando Valley Times had reported Pena's formal retirement from the LAPD. A surprise testimonial dinner was held in his honor at the Sportsman's Lodge, with LAPD Chief Thomas Redden prominent among the law enforcement fraternity in attendance. It was a, quote, rousing and emotion-packed affair, the article said, and then quoted Redden, "I have known Manny for many years. I would not have missed being here for anything." The article revealed, quote, "Pena retired from the police force to advance his career. He has accepted a position with the Agency for International Development, Office of the State Department. As a public safety advisor, he will train and advise foreign police forces in investigative and administrative matters. After 9 weeks of training and orientation, he will be assigned to his post, possibly a Latin American country, judging by the fact that he speaks Spanish fluently. It is an open secret," the authors write, "that the Office of Public Safety of the Agency for International Development, AID, has long served as a cover for the CIA's clandestine program of supplying advisors and instructors for national police and intelligence services in Southeast Asia and Latin America engaged in anti-communist operations. In 1968, California Chief Deputy Attorney General Charles A. O'Brien informed us that this ultra-secret CIA unit was known to insiders as, quote, the Department of Dirty Tricks, and that one of its specialties was teaching foreign, quote, intelligence apparatus the techniques of assassination. FBI agent Roger Lajeunesse, whom Turner had known for years before, whom Turner had known years before in the Bureau, confided that Pena had left the LAPD. Now, this is 6 months before the Kennedy assassination, the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. Had left the LAPD for a, quote, special training unit at a CIA base in Virginia. In fact, said Lajeunesse, Pena's departure in November 1967 had not been a one-shot deal. The detective had done CIA special assignments for a decade, mostly under AID cover. On some of these assignments in Central and South America, he worked with CIA operative Dan A. Mitrione, M-I-T-R-I-O-N-E, a former Indiana chief of police. Further confirmation of Pena's CIA role came from his brother, a high school teacher, who casually mentioned to television newsman Stan Borman how proud Manny was of his services for the CIA over the years. And before Dave continues, I'm just going to mention real quickly a little bit about good old Dan Mitrione. Now, I don't know how many of you out there have seen a movie called State of Siege by Costa Gavras.
The same fellow who just did Missing, which was a big hit a couple of years ago.
Right, about Chile, although they never named Chile.
Similar kind of movie, too.
Right. State of Siege, of course, was about the events that took place in Uruguay, and specifically Dan Mitrione. Dan Mitrione, as you will find, if you would like to find a good book, there's a book by the name of Hidden Terrors by former New York Times writer A.J. Langeth, L-A-N-G-G-U-T-H, that details the entire Mitrione case. But Dan Mitrione was a former Indiana chief of police who went to work for the CIA, was involved in several foreign countries, including Brazil and Uruguay, where he eventually died, with Department of Dirty Tricks, teaching local police forces, governments friendly to the United States, how to, quote, fight terrorism, in most cases how to torture and assassinate, in fact. And among other things that happened, they were bringing in torture equipment in the diplomatic pouch to Dan Mitrione through the embassies. They were bringing in huge needles and equipment for electroshock torture and things like that. So Mitrione himself was eventually kidnapped and apparently killed by Tupamaro's guerrillas in Uruguay. But before that happened, he had a reputation all over South America for brutality and for being one of the United States' chief torture masters in South America. So that's the Dan Mitrione that Manuel Pena went down to South America and worked with at one time before his eventual return to the L.A. Police Department.
And remember now, too, that Dan Mitrione was a boyhood friend of Jim Jones, as we looked at in our program about the assassination of Martin Luther King, in which we talked about the connections between the Martin Luther King assassination and Jonestown. Also worth noting that Jim Jones was in Belo Horizonte, Brazil, at the same time when Dan Mitrione was down there teaching torture and some of his other niceties. And There is a question, recall, in the talk, the interview that I had with John Judge. John, who's an expert on Jonestown, stated that Dan Mitrione was chief of police in the area where Jim Jones sort of got his little revival show going, and that the kind of fraud that Jim Jones used usually requires the active collaboration of the chief of police, because people catch on and complain, and usually it's the chief of police has to be in league with someone like this if they're going to pull it off successfully. So many questions and important questions about the full extent of the relationship between Jim Jones and Dan Mitrione. Recall that Jim Jones's father was a Klan leader in Indiana. Returning again to the accounts here, we'll also remember now that Manny Pena, in November of 67, leaves for a special training assignment. This was 8 months before the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Continuing now with Christian and Turner's narrative. Reporter Fernando Fora, F-A-U-R-A, whose byline appeared in the newspaper story of the farewell banquet, recounted that in April of 1968, only 5 months after Pena's departure, he was sauntering along a corridor in Parker Center when he spotted a vaguely familiar figure. The square face and fireplug frame seemed to belong to Manny Pena, but now he sported an expensive dark blue suit, a black handlebar mustache, and heavy, horn-rimmed glasses. Manny? Fora probed. The figure stopped and looked sheepish as the reporter approached with hand extended. Hey, Manny, I damn near didn't recognize you with that disguise. The detective was not amused. Fora asked what he was doing back in Los Angeles. Pena explained that the AID job wasn't quite what he had expected, so he quit and resumed his duties with the LAPD. And I'll tell you, you're listening to KFJC Los Altos Hills. Pena's stints with the CIA were hardly unique. For example, Hugh C. McDonald, who was chief of detectives for the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department before retiring in 1967, recently revealed in a book that for many years he had gone on detached duty with the CIA as a contract agent, primarily in operations in conjunction with white Russian emigre elements in Europe. Pausing here, by the way. A contract agent simply means that this is an agent who has been hired to do a particular job as opposed to a career employee of the CIA. It does not refer to a contract as in putting out a contract on somebody, mob parlance, for an execution. Okay, it's a point that often gets confused in people's minds. Also note that Hugh C. McDonald wrote a book about the JFK assassination called Appointment in Dallas, which is essentially fertilizer. You know, it's more lone nut stuff with the leftist intimations. Worth noting that he worked not only for CIA, but with white Russian emigre elements in Europe, and the white Russian element in the Galen Nazi intelligence apparatus in this country, as well as the role of both the white Russians and the Galen group in the John Kennedy assassination we've talked about in the past. Continuing here with Turner and Christian's account. And according to Morton Kondracki of the Chicago Sun-Times, quote, a high-ranking former official of the spy agency said in an interview that he remembered some Chicago policemen attending training sessions at the CIA's super-secret facility at Camp Perry near Williamsburg, Virginia, either in late 1967 or early 1968. Recall that in the summer of 1968, interrupting here, Chicago police were very much involved in a series of so-called police riots at the Democratic Convention in 1968. Again, food for thought and, quote, grounds for further research. Were any of those policemen instigating that riot, which essentially trashed what little chance the Democrats had of winning the election, were there any connections between that group and some of these CIA-trained Chicago cops? Again, food for thought, ground for further research. Continuing. The agency itself conceded that briefings, unquote, were given to less than 50 policemen from about a dozen departments, unquote, unquote. And we learn much later that Pena's SUS sidekick, Sergeant Hank Hernandez, who was promoted to lieutenant in recognition of his status in the special unit, also had CIA connections. Now retired from the force, he boasts in a resume offering his services as a private investigator that in 1963, he played a key role in unified police command training for the CIA in Latin America. He functioned under the usual cover of AID's Office of Public Safety and even received a medal from the Venezuelan government, then concerned with Fidel Castro's exportation of the Cuban Revolution. In retrospect, it seems odd that two policemen who doubled as CIA agents occupied key positions in SUS where they were able to seal off avenues that led in the direction of conspiracy. And adding to this, in considering the CIA's role in the assassination of Robert Kennedy, remember that in considering not only Pena and Hernandez here, recall the CIA connections to William Joseph Bryan, his possible role as Cerrone's programmer. Recall also that Thane Eugene Caesar, according to an engineer who worked with him, worked in an area of the Lockheed Burbank plant associated with the CIA's U-2 program. So CIA connections cropping up in a number of different contexts here.
Okay, the aforementioned Jerry Owen we're now going to get into a little bit and begin to look at the interesting role that he plays in the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. We're going to skip over here is a long segment of the book that discusses Owen's background. But basically, Owen was, among other things, sort of an itinerant evangelist preacher who had been involved in all kinds of strange things. He had been, a warrant had been issued for his arrest, and he had been actually convicted of arson conspiracy and the burning down of a church for insurance purposes. He had been involved in other kinds of strange things like that. He had had allegations of fraud, and in many cases actually been taken to court for that and things like that. So this is a cat with sort of a strange background.
In particular, a lot of morals charges. Apparently, now Jerry Owen was a religious evangelist billed as the walking Bible. He apparently knew the whole Bible, according to his billing, by memory and could recite long passages of it from memory. He was a Bible-thumping religious evangelist who had a penchant for morals busts, I guess you could say. He was always turning up in motel rooms, confessing underage girls who frequently wound up being pregnant after having been confessed. And so the point is that Jerry Owens had a very shady record, and, well, that shady record didn't stop him from moving in some very, very interesting circles.
Okay, reading from the assassination, Robert F. Kennedy. By 1968, Owen was living in Santa Ana, 30 miles south of Los Angeles in Orange County. He styled himself, quote, the Shepherd of the Hills, and circulated around shopping centers giving free pony rides to children who promised to memorize a Bible verse and attend church on Sunday. He traded horses on the side, and he owned a piece of a club fighter named Irish Rip O'Reilly. It was the horses and the boxing game, Owen testified in the KCOP trial, which we'll be looking at in depth later, that brought about his chance association with Sirhan Sirhan. On the afternoon of June 3rd, 1968, the eve of the California primary election, he, Jerry Owen, said that he was driving his pickup truck through downtown Los Angeles on his way to purchase some boxing gear for O'Reilly. At a red light, he let two hitchhikers climb into the back of the truck. After a dozen or so blocks, they got off at another red light and appeared to converse with a man and woman standing on the corner. As Owen got ready to pull away, one of the hitchhikers got in the cab with him and struck up a conversation. Owen described him as a diminutive young man of foreign extraction who remarked that he worked as an exercise boy at a racetrack. When Owen mentioned that he traded horses as a sideline to his ministry, the young man said that he was in the market for a lead pony, used to walk horses around the track before and after races. After some haggling, he agreed to buy a Palomino from Owen for $300. Mind you, this whole section here is Jerry Owen's account of his first meeting with Sirhan Sirhan. What some other suggestions of how it all worked out, we'll find out in a little bit.
Well, what Jerry Owen claims was his first meeting with Sirhan. Very important distinction.
Exactly.
According to Owen, he simply picked Sirhan up hitchhiking on June 3rd, never seen the guy before. Remember that.
Right. The young man asked Owen to stop for a few minutes at the rear entrance to the Ambassador Hotel so that he could run in and, quote, see a friend in the kitchen. Owen obliged. When he returned, the young man told Owen that he would meet him that night with the money for the horse. But at the appointed time and place, the young man, accompanied by the same two men and the woman he had been seen with that afternoon, said he hadn't been able to raise all of the money. He produced a single $100 bill. The upshot of this intricate story was that Owen was asked to deliver the horse to the same rear entrance of the hotel the following night at 11, at which time the full amount would be paid. But Owen couldn't make it because he was due to preach a sermon in Oxnard, 70 miles northwest of Los Angeles. When Owen returned to Los Angeles on the morning after the election, he recognized Sirhan's picture on television as the hitchhiker who was going to buy his horse. At the urge of some friends, he went straight to the police and told his story, quote, like a good citizen. He felt that he nearly had been duped into becoming part of a bizarre getaway scheme after Kennedy was shot at the Ambassador Hotel the previous night. Okay, so before we go on with this any further, let me just mention that. So Jerry Owen is initially was stipulating that he had never seen Sirhan Sirhan before, that he had picked him up hitchhiking, that they had gotten into a conversation about horses, and that Sirhan had asked him to come and bring the horse to the back of the Ambassador Hotel on the night that turned out to be the night of the assassination, where he would be paid $300. The idea being here on, presumably, that Jerry Owen is insinuating was that Sirhan Sirhan was somehow going to leap into this horse trailer and therefore being, of course, totally inconspicuous, driving in a horse trailer trailer in the parking lot of the Ambassador Hotel, thereby escape after assassinating Robert Kennedy. Anyway, this was Jerry Owens' preliminary a stipulation as to what his contact with Sirhan Sirhan was.
Now, we're going to present some information here, which is going to call Jerry Owens' account very seriously into question. And it's important to pay attention to the nature of the Owen and Sirhan relationship, not to sound patronizing, but Jerry Owen, perhaps more than any other single individual available in the literature or accessible in the literature, sort of delineates the political milieu behind the assassination of Robert Kennedy better than anybody, at least I can think of offhand from the information I've read. Jerry Owen essentially had more connections than a switchboard, and those connections are very, very important in illustrating, as I say, the political milieu underlying Robert Kennedy's assassination. And again, Jerry Owen claims he just picked up Sirhan hitchhiking on June 3rd, had never seen him before. As to whether or not that statement holds water, well, evaluate it in light of the following information. Returning to Christian and Turner's account, the man Weatherly here is a horse trader associated with, among others, Owen and Sirhan and a fellow named Bill Powers. Now, Bill Powers, again, is another horse breeder and a cowboy who is involved here with Owen and Sirhan. And according to Bill Powers now, Jerry Owen not only knew Sirhan before, but the previously impoverished or penny-pinching minister who had barely been able to make ends meet showed up flashing a roll of large bills, okay, large denomination bills.
With Sirhan Sirhan in the back seat of his car, as I recall.
The day, weeks before they, or several days before the assassination. All right, now, again, Owen claims he'd never met Sirhan before. That appears to be a doubtful claim in light of the following information. Powers corrected Weatherly's impression that Owen and Sirhan had borrowed his late model Chevrolet truck on election day to drive into Los Angeles. When he bought this vehicle, he sold Owen his old 1951 Chevrolet pickup that Owen had previously borrowed to haul hay. So then a few weeks before the assassination, he came down and bought the truck, Powers explained. The price was either $300 or $350, and Owen made a $50 down payment. Powers hung on to the pink slip, proving ownership until the balance would be paid. It never was. On or about Monday, June 3rd, now recall this is 2 days before Robert Kennedy dies, this is the day that Owen claims he picked up Sirhan hitchhiking, it never was. On or about Monday, June 3rd, Powers related, Owens drove into Wild Bill's stables at the wheel of a late model Lincoln Continental four-door sedan. This is a fellow who used to have to borrow money to buy hay for his horses. Again, repeating this. On or about Monday, June 3rd, Powers related, Owen drove into Wild Bill's stables at the wheel of a late-model Lincoln Continental four-door sedan. When Powers brought up the money due, the preacher nodded and said he had to go to the bank. Upon returning, he fished in his pocket and pulled out a roll of $1,000 bills. I don't know how many of them there was, the cowboy marveled, but there was a big handful of them. I'll pay you for that truck, Owen said, peeling off a $1,000 bill. Jerry, I don't have no change for that, Powers replied. Well, I'll have to go to the bank and get one cashed and bring you back the money for the truck. Again, a man with a roll of $1,000 bills previously had to borrow money to buy hay for his horses and in a new late-model Lincoln Continental sedan. Returning to Turner and Christian's account, Owen drove off in his luxury car but didn't return. The assassination was the next day, I guess, Powers said. I never did figure him, he continued. He often had to borrow a bundle of hay. I don't know where he got his money, but it sure wasn't in the horse business. Could Owen have flashed a Montana bankroll, Christian asked, referring to a roll of $100 bills covered with a $1,000 note that con men used to impress their victims? No, 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 Powers insisted. He knew a Montana bankroll when he saw one. Oh, no, I'd say there was probably 25, maybe 30 of them at least. They filled one pocket, and there were money orders, traveler's checks, something like that, in the other pocket. He showed me that roll of bills a couple of times. He showed them to all of us there. The sight of Owen in his flashy new car had attracted several of the stable hands. Johnny Beckley was one of them. If Powers was correct, the walking Bible was walking around with a cool $25,000 to $30,000 in cash. But if he had any fear of being mugged, he wasn't relying on the Lord for his only protection. With him that afternoon were two other men, one a bulky and powerful-looking black man, and the other young, small, and, quote, Mexican-looking, unquote. How did Owen introduce him? Christian asked. Can't remember what his name was, Powers replied. He had a friend or a partner or an associate. I shook hands with him and the nigger both. Was Sirhan with him when he had the roll of $1,000 bills? Ah, yeah, Powers was slightly hesitant, perhaps feeling himself slipping into deep waters. He backed off a bit by saying there was two guys with him. Did the kid get out of the pickup and walk around? It was a rigged question, but the cowboy wasn't trapped. No, he was in the car, he corrected. He just raised forward there, and I shook hands with him.
Continuing, shortly after the assassination, Bill Powers told Christian, again, that's John Christian, one of the authors, he returned from a brief trip trying to round up wild Mustangs to be broken and trained when his stablehands told him, the FBI's been looking for you. Two men identifying themselves as bureau agents had come by in an unmarked beige Chevrolet. Concerned, Powers dialed the FBI resident agency in Riverside, but was informed that there was no record there or in Los Angeles that he was being sought. A day or so later, two plainclothesmen showed up, but they said they were from the LAPD. It was a routine interview, apparently prompted by the fact that Powers was still listed as the legal owner of the pickup truck Owen had driven. The policeman mentioned that the truck had been dusted for fingerprints and that Sir Hans had in fact been found on the glove compartment and rear window. Then, about a week later, the first pair of detectives reappeared, driving the same Chevrolet. They announced themselves as FBI and flashed credentials. They told Powers that the old pickup truck had been recovered in Barstow, had been recovered abandoned in Barstow, some 130 miles northeast of Los Angeles on the route to Las Vegas, and had been brought back to the FBI crime lab in Los Angeles for fingerprint testing. In a menacing manner, they demanded to know what Powers knew about Owen and Sirhan and the RFK case. Quote, they tried to scare me, Powers recounted. They tried to give me a bunch of bullshit at first. They wanted to make sure I knew who they were and that they weren't fooling around. All I told them is what they asked me. I didn't make no statements, no nothing. Powers said that the putative FBI man handed him a card, quote, and told me that if anybody tried to arrest me or pick me up to phone them. Okay, let me read that sentence again. Powers said that the putative FBI man handed him a card, quote, and told me that if anybody tried to arrest me or pick me up, to phone them before I went with them, that I wasn't to get in no cars or anything like that. They told me it was for my own protection. They might bump me off. The cowboy was specifically instructed not even to speak to other law enforcement officers. Turning nastier, the pair intimated that they had been watching Powers, knew of his dalliance with a girl of, quote, jailbait age, and might have to bust him if he didn't cooperate. The, quote, FBI agents, unquote, returned three times in the next few months. They asked me something, and I'd tell them if I wanted to, and if I didn't say nothing. I figured it was none of their business if that was Sirhan with Owen in the car, Powers declared. I mean, I don't care who it was, you know. There's no use getting involved. Why should I care who it was, you know? Why should I get involved? The only thing it might do is get me killed or something. I'll tell you the truth. I'm kind of scared.
Basically, so according to Bill Powers, not only did Sirhan and Owen know each other before, but that 2 days before the assassination, the previously impoverished or practically impoverished Owen showed up with a roll of $1,000 bills, a brand new Lincoln Continental, and a lot of other money, and Sirhan was in the car with him, which certainly gives the lie to Jerry Owen's accounting of having just picked Sirhan up hitchhiking. And we're going to look at how Powers' testimony was handled in the KCOP versus Jerry Owen case here in a little while. Now, another very important accounting of the event, a different accounting of Jerry Owen's contact with Sirhan, comes from a fellow named the Reverend Jonathan Perkins, who's, an ultra-right-wing evangelist from Southern California, who's part of a paramilitary evangelical milieu down there, which, again, we're going to go back to in our broadcast next month about the Aryan Nations neo-Nazi group. Again, about Reverend Jonathan Perkins, Marshall Turner and Christian write as follows. The Reverend Jonathan Perkins, the elderly minister who Owen said accompanied him for the interview at SUS headquarters, did not appear at first glance to be a promising witness. He was a longtime friend of Owen, and for over 20 years had been personal secretary to the late Gerald L. K. Smith, the virulent anti-Semite who founded the Christian Nationalist Crusade. Perkins conducted his own ministry at the Embassy Auditorium in downtown Los Angeles, a favorite meeting place for right-wing fundamentalists. The Christian Nationalist Crusade held meetings there, as did the racist Church of Jesus Christ Christian. And occasionally, Jerry Owen staged revival meetings there. In an asterisk to the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, we have the following note. The Church of Jesus Christ Christian figured prominently in the previously mentioned investigation by the California Attorney General's Office into right-wing paramilitary groups. It was led by the Reverend Wesley A. Swift of Lancaster on the fringe of the Mojave Desert. According to the Attorney General's 1965 report, Swift was, quote, a former Ku Klux Klan rifle team instructor and legal representative of Gerald L. K. Smith. It said that he, quote, has purchased over 100 concealable firearms in the past few years. Moreover, he maintains a firing range on his Kern County ranch, as well as a reported secret arsenal, unquote. The church had a paramilitary arm called the Christian Defense League. In 1976, after Swift's death, a huge buried arsenal including ground-to-air missiles was discovered on lands that had belonged to Swift, touching off an investigation leading to the arrest and conviction of an East Los Angeles man linked to extremist causes. Again, remember the Christian Defense League and the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, Gerald L. K. Smith and Wesley Swift, because we're coming back to those in our discussion of the Aryan Nations again next week. Now, as far as Jonathan Perkins' accounting of Owen's meeting with Saran, it's as follows. As it turned out, however, the white-maned Perkins was a goldmine of information. He related that on the morning of June 5th, Owen telephoned him and asked if he could come right over to his apartment in the hotel adjacent to the embassy auditorium. When he arrived a few minutes later, Owen was visibly shaken. I'm about to get mixed up in that thing, Owen said in reference to the RFK shooting, and I don't want to get mixed up in another scandal like that, unquote. It was the second visit from Owen in 2 days. Perkins revealed that on election day, June 4th, Owen had dropped by and mentioned that a former exercise boy at a racetrack was going to buy one of his horses. Owen said that he met the young man hitchhiking the day before, and he thought that a price of $400 had been reached. The only reason that Owen was hanging around Los Angeles was to complete the sale. He had the horse trailer with him and was to meet the young man and some friends of his that same night. You mean he was supposed to meet Saran at the ambassador the night of the election? Christian asked. Oh, yes, the night Kennedy was shot, Perkins confirmed. He was out there with his horse and trailer? Well, he was here in town. He came up here. I knew about that. I wasn't with him. I talked with him the next day or so. Christian reiterated his question about whether Owen was actually at the Ambassador Hotel on election night. As Perkins recalled it, Owen said that on election night he, quote, went down there to meet him and to pick up this other $300. That was the night of the assassination. He waited around there, and when Saran didn't show up, he went to a hotel here. Thought he'd stay all night, and Saran would very likely show up in the morning because he was very much interested in the horse. If I remember correctly, he went to some little motel in Hollywood so he wouldn't have to drive back and haul his horse trailer to Santa Ana.
Continuing, Perkins said that when Owen came by about 10 in the morning on June 5th, he seemed genuinely frightened at the asserted chance encounter with Saran. Quote, listen, he told Perkins, that's the fellow that was going to buy my horse. I brought the horse in here to deliver it. The other man didn't show up and so forth. I waited for him. Man alive, they was just going to use me as a getaway, as a scapegoat. They could have gone 4 or 5 miles and shot me in a vacant lot. What Perkins had to say seemed enormously important, for here for the first time was a witness to whom Owen had related the hitchhiker story before the shooting. It was a significantly different version from what he had told Turner about going to Oxnard on election day. Owen gave Perkins the impression that he was in Los Angeles with a horse and trailer from at least late Monday through Tuesday, and that he had been waiting outside the Ambassador Hotel for Sirhan when the shooting happened.
Alrighty, so apparently, according again to this Reverend Jonathan Perkins, and remember that he moves in a right-wing evangelical paramilitary milieu, which we're going to touch on next week, and which includes Jerry Owen. Remember about the Christian Defense League, its head, a fellow named Gail, we're going to talk about in our next Radio Free America broadcast. Now, one of the fellows that again, moves in this Southern California paramilitary milieu. One of the fellows who moved was a guy named Edgar Eugene Bradley. Now, he was also associated with Gale, the Christian Defense League, and so forth, as we'll talk about in our next program. But Edgar Eugene Bradley is a name which crops up in connection with the assassination of John Kennedy. Recall now from our Guns of November broadcast, or perhaps your own knowledge, that New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison attempted unsuccessfully to have 3 people extradited to testify in his investigation of the assassination of Kennedy. One of those was Edgar Eugene Bradley, who was identified by Dallas policeman Roger Craig as having basically flashed phony Secret Service credentials to have an Oswald or Oswald double released from police custody shortly after the assassination of JFK. Now, Edgar Eugene Bradley was a member of a right-wing church called the American Council of Christian Churches, headed up by Reverend Carl McIntyre, an ultra-right-wing group. And then-governor of California, Ronald Reagan, turned down the extradition request without comment, waiting till after Richard Nixon was elected president. Now Attorney General, then legal counselor to then-governor Reagan, Ed Meese, handled the cover-up, or handled the day-to-day... Basically, he was in charge of the handling of the Edgar Eugene Bradley case. Now, the Deputy State Attorney General, Charles O'Brien, who reviewed this case, we've heard references to before, and we're going to come back to him later in the broadcast. Edgar Eugene Bradley also was an associate of Jerry Owens. Returning to Turner and Christian's account. After Davis, George T. Davis, by the way, a Northern California investigator, after Davis left the room to make some phone calls, Owen raised the question of John Kennedy's assassination. Obviously, Davis had briefed him on Turner's participation in the Jim Garrison investigation. As Turner spread a number of photographs from his attaché case on the table, Owen looked them over. His finger came to rest on one of Edgar Eugene Bradley of North Hollywood, who 6 months before had been indicted by a New Orleans grand jury for conspiracy in the JFK assassination. The charges were later dismissed. Bradley was the West Coast representative of Dr. Carl McIntyre, the fundamentalist minister who founded the American Council of Christian Churches in opposition to the modernist, unquote, National Council of Churches. "Do you know Bradley?" Turner asked. "Yes," said Owen. He explained that he had casually met him a couple of times in Los Angeles, the last in 1964. "I was affiliated with McIntyre's church in the late 50s, Owen said, "but got out because those people were too radical for me." That, essentially, Jerry Owen hooks up with Edgar Eugene Bradley, again, one of the key figures in Garrison's investigation, and whose extradition was blocked by then-governor of California, Ronald Reagan.
Okay. Turner and Christian go on to detail the story, Jerry Owen's version of his story, most of which we've related to you earlier, just explaining how he left Santa Ana in his old Chevy pickup, supposedly stopped at this red light, was convinced to give a ride to Sirhan Sirhan and another young man, and that various things of this sort that were going on and things like that. Anyway. So at this point, in what's going on, Christian and Turner, our authors, are not necessarily convinced that Jerry Owen himself is, telling a lie, but they basically are beginning to wonder about some of the inconsistencies in Jerry Owen's story that had developed, and why Jerry Owen came forward with his story in the first place, why that people involved with Jerry Owen were getting this strange treatment from Special Unit Senator and possibly the FBI. Okay. On a hunch, Christian called Owen's younger brother, Richard Owen, an instructor at Los Angeles Trade Tech College. He didn't know Gray, but he was familiar. Gray is Johnny Gray, I believe his name is, right, who was...
Johnny Gray, as mentioned, Jerry Owen was involved with, among other things, prize fighting. Johnny Gray was one of the fellows associated both with his horse trading and, to a certain extent, with training some of Owen's fighters. Owen himself, a former prize fighter. The key name here now in Owen's fight game is a guy named Irish Rip O'Reilly, who Owen owned part of and who apparently he co-managed with a guy named Edward Glenn, and that's the key name here. So Irish Rip O'Reilly is a fighter owned in part by Owen, co-managed with a guy named Edward Glenn by Owen.
And Johnny Gray was the black man mentioned earlier by Bill Powers, the cowboy, as having been in the car with Sir Han when Owen came and flashed the roll of money. Okay. He, Jerry Owen's younger brother, didn't know Gray, but he was familiar with a man named Edward E. Glenn, who had claimed he was O'Reilly's co-manager with his brother, Jerry Owen, and footed the bills for the fighters' stay at the Coliseum Hotel. Perhaps Glenn would know where Gray was. Glenn was president of the Midland Oil Company of Wyoming, which purportedly was exploring for oil in that state. Glenn had sold stock in the company to Richard Owen and several other instructors. When he became uneasy about his investment, Owen said, Glenn assigned him, quote, stock in O'Reilly as a good faith gesture. Glenn left Los Angeles immediately after the assassination, and Richard Owen had not heard from him since. A check with Dun & Bradstreet disclosed that Midland Oil had been headquartered in Littleton, Colorado in 1968, but had disappeared, abandoning a single Wildcat well in Lusk, Wyoming. The dry hole venture was under investigation by the Attorney General of Wyoming for possible violation of state securities laws regarding the sale of unregistered stock and fraud. Since Glenn appeared to have been a fast buck operator in several states, we threw his name at FBI agent Roger LaJeunesse. Quote, how did you get on to him? Lajeunesse asked with an astonished look on his face. Yes, he said, the mysterious Mr. Glenn had come to the attention of the Bureau. Glenn moved in circles known to have right-wing views and underworld ties. His headquarters had been in Littleton, all right, but he frequently ranged to Los Angeles, San Diego, Phoenix, Albuquerque, Dallas, Miami, New Orleans, and Chicago, as well as Central and South America. His line, quote, oil equipment salesman. You guys know Jim Braden? Lajeunesse asked, knowing the answer full well. He and Glenn pal around together on occasion, from Miami to San Diego, with stops in between like Dallas and New Orleans.